Tag, you're giving yourself peace of mind, and you're supporting the CHAMP program for child amputees. If you lose your keys, the WARAMPS can return them to you by courier with the help of your personalized key tag. Key return by courier. It's simple, fast, and it's free. What's more, thanks to your support, child amputees receive the artificial limbs they need to lead active lives. Order your key tags at 1-800-250-3030 or waramps.ca.
As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to spread, it is important to stay safe. Coronavirus is now in Canadian provinces and territories. By law, if you have traveled abroad recently, you must self-isolate. To do your part, stay home as much as possible and practice social distancing. Try to maintain at least 2 meters away from others. Encourage those who are sick or showing symptoms to self-isolate or to seek medical attention. As always, wash your hands frequently, avoid touching your face, and practice good respiratory etiquette by covering your coughs and sneezes. Clean regularly used surfaces. COVID-19 symptoms can mimic colds and flu and include fever, cough, and difficulty breathing. Infected individuals may also have mild symptoms or none at all. For up-to-date information, check reliable sources like your local health authority or the Public Health Agency of Canada.
Good morning, you're listening to CILU 102.7 FM. I'm Joshua with It's Pretty Trivial. Hopefully everyone's having a good Tuesday morning. I know it's been a few weeks, but there was a cyber attack at LU which caused some issues with getting the show out on time, and last week's show was recorded 2 weeks ago, unfortunately. However, I am back this week, and I'm hoping, crossing my fingers, this episode comes out on the 16th of March. Not the 16th of March, the 9th of March. I'm looking a week too far in advance. Anyway, today's episode is about something that I thought, I'm recording it on a Sunday night, trying to look for something I hadn't talked about before, and I kind of thought, wait a second, here's an interesting topic. It is the story of an island that a TV series is based off of on the History Channel that is really interesting, and it talks about buried treasure, and it's really, really an interesting thing. And in this episode, I kind of want to talk about some of the history of the island, and also what is some of the stuff that is said to have been buried there, and some of the theories and rumors, and kind of a little bit about the show. As even if it's some of it is fiction or not true or yet to be proven, I think it's a really good story nonetheless. Now, believe it or not, I actually heard about this story back when I was in about grade 6. I believe I read about it when I was studying for my EQAO test. I can't even quite remember. It's been a long time. But I read about the island there, and I'm sure many Canadians even have. And I know that the story of the show, the people that own the island from the show, actually heard about it through a Reader's Digest in Canada many, many years ago. And that got them into, well, owning the island. I'm sure a lot of you already know what island this is, and this is Oak Island. Now, where is Oak Island located? Well, let me just... The location is actually in Nova Scotia. So, it's a 57-hectare privately owned island in the Lunenburg County of the South Shore of Nova Scotia. It is one of about 360 small islands in the Mahone Bay and rises to a maximum of about 11 meters above sea level. And the thing is this island is shrouded in secrecy. There's mysteries about it, rumors, conspiracy theories, and you can even go tour the island. There's Smith's Cove, the Money Pit, 10X, all things we're going to cover. But this quiet, sleepy little town is just southwest of Halifax, surprisingly. And it's not that big of an area. And out of all islands, the 360, this one is the one that has the most to it. So let's talk about some of the early history. First, the Mi'kmaq people, which were the First Nations people, which made Nova Scotia and Atlantic Canada their home for thousands of years. And Nova Scotia is home to 10,000 plus year old Paleo-Indian sites. In 1,000 plus, the Norse settled in L'Anse aux Meadows, Newfoundland, and evidence found there suggests they traveled further south to the place they called Vinland. Skip forward a bit, you get to the 1520s, when Portuguese explorer Estevão Gomes explored the coast, and a group of Portuguese fishermen from Azores created a fishing station there. In 1566, cartographer Bolognini Zaltarelli gave the name L'Arcadia to an area that includes Nova Scotia and New Brunswick. In 1604, Samuel de Champlain settled in what is now called Fort Le Heve, in the Le Havre River, not far from Mahone Bay. In 1605, Champlain went on to build Port Royal Habitation in the Bay of Fundy. From 1621 to 1632, Sir William Alexander created the Royal Charter of Nova Scotia in an attempt to create a new Scotland with early attempts at settlement. The Order of the Knight Baronets of Nova Scotia was created in 1624, the Nova Scotia Coat of Arms in 1626, and Scottish Occupation of Port Royal from 1629 to 32. Now, I am getting a lot of my info from oakislandtours.ca. Between 1629 and 1632, the French were holding on to their land claim at Fort St. Louis near Port Latour, Nova Scotia. And for a brief period, the French reestablished Fort La Heve. And then in 1654, Nova Scotia was under English rule. And then 1667, French rule. And then in 1671, the first official French census. And then a bunch of other... And then after the census in 1690, it was Nova Scotia was taken by New England adventurer Sir William Phipps and then returned to the French in 1697. Finally, it was passed to the English for good in 1713 by the Treaty of Utrecht. And then in 1649, the English started to colonize it with foreign Protestants. In 1753, the first recorded owners of Oak Island were New York fish merchants Richard Smith and John Gifford. In 1755, Captain Lewis included Oak Island on his charts. And in 1759, British Governor of Nova Scotia, Charles Lawrence, approved the Shoreham Grant, which offered free land grants as a way to generate population growth. In 1762, Shoreham Grant land, which included Oak Island, was approved by Charles Morris, Surveyor General of Nova Scotia, and the island was subdivided into 32 four-acre lots. Now, in 1783, it was the end of the American Revolution, and it sent a wave of settlers, the United Empire Loyalists, to the area. And in 1791, a poll tax record shows that Oak Island was inhabited and being farmed. Now, this is kind of the early Nova Scotia and history of the island. Now, I do kind of want to mention it as much as I'm not really talking about it, because a lot of the stuff that is said to be on this island predates a lot of the history of the island by quite a while, and some of the things do, if they are true, do really change a lot of the stuff that we know about even Canadian history, for example. Now, again, I'm not saying a lot of what I'm going to say is all true, but a lot of Oak Island is, you know, speculation. Now, the story of it is very just interesting in general. There's many things said to be have been buried there. For example, things like Captain Kidd's treasure, things like Sir Francis Bacon's tomb. They even say things like Shakespearean manuscripts or religious artifacts like the Ark of the Covenant are stored on Oak Island. Now, this was all set off when an unassuming dot of land was paid little attention until 1795, when a teenage boy discovered a circular depression in the ground and started digging. As he and his friends dug, they discovered layers of what? They discovered layers of logs and what was believed to be pick scrapings along the walls of the pit. Soon after, another group of treasure seekers took over, convinced that the so-called money pit was the site of a long-lost buried treasure, possibly belonging to Captain Kidd or Blackbeard. They even claimed to have found a flagstone etched with symbols that, according to an amateur cryptologist, translated into 40 feet below, 2 million pounds lie buried. And over the past 200 years, despite the difficulties and risks, where six men have actually died digging, there have been many determined efforts to find Oak Island's treasure, even attracting the interests of who? Even interesting people like the U.S. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Today, it's very famous on the TV series Curse of Oak Island, which I do watch, and is filmed on Oak Island as the Lagina brothers continue their search for treasure, and it likely won't be stopped until the mystery is solved. Now, I will say the interesting thing about this, actually, is there is a history show of it, and it's on pretty regularly, and again, it's a really interesting thing to watch, because what I'm going to mention here, who would think that that kind of stuff would be buried on this island? And that's why I think it's intriguing. Even if not all of it is true, it's still really stimulating and just interesting about the history. Now, I am going to get some of my facts from Wikipedia, but I have heard a lot of history and seen a lot about the island and do believe some of it may actually be true. Now, I'm going to try and find as much as I can that's kind of been talked about or some of the diggers there. But again, it's not going to be perfect, as there's a lot to talk about just on this tiny little island. Now, interestingly, one of the first people to find it in 1795 was a guy named Daniel McGinnis. Now, Daniel McGinnis and his friends were the ones to originally dig up the treasure. And that is just a little, that is just the first bit of it. Now, the thing, there is some main characters in this story. For example, I mentioned that Daniel McGinnis was one of the first. But an interesting fellow about the island is actually said to have maybe found part of the treasure. Or maybe even have been one of the people that helped Daniel McGinnis dig up the treasure. As it is said that Daniel McGinnis did get some wealth afterwards. Now, it's really interesting because the first one is a guy named Samuel Ball. Now, he was a very important person back in the day. He was a black loyalist, and he moved to Nova Scotia around the time of 1783. And it was really interesting because he arrived with a lot of settlers. And what he originally done was serve 3 years with black pioneers in the Revolutionary War. And in their job, they helped prepare the area for settlers and mainly cleared forests and building of roads. And Samuel Ball spent some time in Birchtown, which would have steeled his resolve to not only improve his and his family's lot, to build a life, to get away to a place where he could live in peace and security. The black pioneers were mustered out in August of 1784, and Sam truly became a free man. But he learned that that didn't mean equality. In his 2 years in Birchtown, he lived through the disappointment of broken promises, abject poverty, and famine. The fear of slave owners returning for their goods and desperate search for work, and the violence of the first race riots in North America in July of 1784. And, well, he left. Now, the thing is he eventually moved to Nova Scotia. And he made a house on, well, Oak Island. And it said throughout his life, he was just a humble cabbage farmer that lived his life. But interestingly enough, he eventually ended up amassing a small fortune. And he ended up owning a bunch of lots on Oak Island, and even became one of the richest people in Oak Island. Or sorry, in all of Nova Scotia. Now, the reason this is very interesting is because many people think that maybe some of the money and some of the stuff that's never been found on Oak Island, he could have found some of it. And again, in recent studies, they have found that his house and his property might have had some secret areas where he could have stored things. That is a really kind of important part of the island. As again, without that, who knows? Maybe they would never think that someone found any of it. But that is one of the interesting things about the island. Again, you're listening to CILU 102.7 FM. That's just one of the stories. Another is, well, The ideas of the local folklore of the money pit in 1795. It is said that while roaming Oak Island, Donald Daniel McGinnis discovered an area on Lot 18, which is part of the island, that appeared to have been worked in the past. An old oak tree had a block and tackle suspended over a depression in the ground. Stories and speculations of Captain William Kidd's treasure were popular at the time. McGinnis eventually returned with John Smith and Anthony Vaughan Jr., and the tree dug but could not get past 30 feet. Now, alternative story versions of this story suggest that the three friends were there and the island was uninhabited. And that research shows that Daniel McGinnis was 38, John Smith 19, and Anthony Vaughan Jr. 13 in 1795. There's a lot of story. And again, in 1870, people suggest that it was actually Samuel Ball who also helped discover the money pit. Now, this is important, as this is what started the whole craze of the money pit in the first place. Now, the reason I think this is an important thing to mention is because none of this would exist without it. Now, if you looked up Oak Island, and if you did a little bit of research or knew anything, one thing you would find out is that, believe it or not, the money pit has been lost for almost 100 years. For a long time, no one has known what happened, where the exact money pit is. No one knows exactly where it is. Now, that is very interesting for a reason, where a lot of people don't know what actually where it exactly is. And that's one of the big things that the show is talking about, is them trying to rediscover the money pit and figure out a few other places where on the island, well, things could be buried or hidden or anything like that. Now, again, the 1795 story could be nothing or it could be something. And there have been many people saying that nothing is there and many people saying there are things there. Either way, for over 200 years, people have actually been looking for this treasure. And many people think they know what's there or where to find it or how to find it. And it is said that there's stories that Daniel McGinnis actually found the money pit because someone told him where it was. I think someone said the Freemasons. Now, again, a common story of the island is that the Knights Templar actually built the money pit. And the Knights Templar and the Freemasons were very kind of involved. And that was passed down to Daniel McGinnis, who himself was a Freemason, who eventually dug it up. Now, this is very interesting, as again, there's not much historical facts to back it up. But again, there's lots to this story. And we will get into what some of the more recent things are eventually. But after Daniel McGinnis, a company eventually took over. And in 1804, the Onslow Company was formed by Anthony Vaughan Jr.'s cousin, Simon Linz, and a group of prominent businessmen from central Nova Scotia to continue the hunt. The company joined the three original searchers to locate the dig area on Lot 18. When they dug past the original 30-foot level, oak log platforms, about every 10 feet, were found, and at 50, 60, and 70-foot levels, layers of putty, charcoal, and coconut fiber were encountered. And at 90 feet, a flat stone was found face down with unusual markings cut into the rock. Now, I'll quickly deviate and mention this, because a lot of people think that it may have incorrectly been deciphered or written down, and a lot of people think that maybe it wasn't even copied 100% correctly, but there is copies that exist of what was supposedly on it. But interestingly enough, in the early 1900s, it disappeared without a trace, and that's another thing they have been trying to find for many years to confirm or deny what was said. But again, the 90-foot stone, as it's called, is one of those very mythical things on Oak Island, like most things. Now, whether you believe in it or not, I still think it's a really interesting story. And again, I know this is more of a conspiracy-like episode, but I just think this story is so good to not, it's too good to not mention. Now, after removing the 90-foot stone, a metal rod was used to probe to 98 feet, where a solid object was hit, and work ended for about a week. But when they returned, the shaft had filled with about 60 feet of water, and a pump was brought in to remove the water from the shaft, but it burst before any water made it to the surface. In 1805, the Onslow Company devised a plan to dig a second shaft, 110 feet deep, and 14 feet to the east of the money pit. Now, and then they would tunnel under the money pit and remove the treasure from below the 90-foot level. Shaft 2 managed to get within a few feet of the object, of the objective, before the tunnel began to flood, barely allowing the men to escape with their lives. This left two shafts full of water, no treasure, exhausted funds, and the end of the operation for the Onslow Company. Now, no original documents relating to it have ever been found. And interestingly, after this, the money pit was, well, kind of not exactly lost, but one of the things that they've done recently, and if you watch the show, you'll know, is that they're trying to use tunneling techniques with a big sonic drilling rig, and they're drilling holes to try and locate tunnels or voids in the earth and figure out where a tunnel might be. Now, what they're actually trying to locate is, yes, they want to find the money pit, but what they've really been trying to do is find Shaft 2, because they know, hey, if we know the location of Shaft 2, we can find the original money pit off of the data we know. And it's been unsuccessful so far, but they think they may have actually found the Shaft 2. And even if it's not exactly the money pit, they do know that they are very close to it. And this is one of the interesting parts of the island. Is, again, I don't really believe in it, but interestingly enough, is Oak Island seems that once you get close to figuring something out, something goes wrong. Now, 45 years would pass between the different times, between, you know, the original money pit and when the Truro Company came around. But in 1849, the Truro Company made an attempt again on Oak Island. And during this time, the island was being used for farming by John Smith, one of the three original searchers. Daniel McGinnis had also died by this point. The first task was to re-excavate the money pit to 86 feet. At this level, the water began entering and drove the workers out. Once again, bailing proved useless and work was temporarily suspended. Later that summer, they returned with a hand-operated pod auger, which was used in coal prospecting. A platform was set up for drilling, and the money pit at a depth of 30 feet, just above the water level. They bored 5 holes into the money pit. The first hole, they lost the core sample. In the second, they struck a platform which the previous Onslow Company had found at 98 feet with the crowbar. The drilling auger went through this upper platform, which was made of 5 inches of spruce wood, then a 12-inch gap, 4 inches of oak wood, 22 inches of loose metal, and 8 inches of oak wood. This was thought to be the bottom of 2 treasure chests, or barrels, containers, one stacked on top of the next between 2 platforms. Then the drill went through 22 inches of loose metal, 4 inches of, or sorry, with the third hole, the same platform was struck again at 98 feet. Passing through, the auger fell 18 inches, then it came into contact with the side of a cask or barrel. On withdrawing the auger, oak splinters such as those from the side of a barrel stave and coconut fiber again were brought up. The reported distance between these two upper and lower platforms was within 6 feet of each other. Three links of metal resembling an ancient gold watch chain were also brought up by the auger. The final two holes were drilled near the inside walls of the pit. Three pieces of copper wire were also brought up from the fifth hole. After sinking more exploratory holes in the money pit, John Gammell noticed James Pitblidow taking something off the end of the auger and slipping it into his pocket. When asked about it by Gammell, Pitblidow told him he would reveal it at the next meeting of directors. He never showed up at the next meeting. He later unsuccessfully tried to buy land on Oak Island. And he later actually supervised work searching for coal in Chester area in 1875. However, the next summer in 1850, the Truro Company sunk another shaft, Shaft 3, which was about 10 feet northwest of the money pit. No water was encountered in the new shaft, which was down to about 109 feet through red clay. A tunnel was driven from the bottom in the direction of the money pit, where again water burst in and men barely escaped with their lives. In 20 minutes, 45 feet of water flooded the new shaft. Water billing was used in these old and new shafts until two horse gins for about a week, day and night, were used, but made barely a noticeable difference in the water level. It was discovered that the water filling the pit was salt water, and that this water level rose and fell 18 inches with the tides. It gave searchers the idea that the water source must somehow be connected to the sea. But before we do that, we got a quick word from our sponsor. So please stay tuned here on CILU 102.7 FM.
CILU is sponsored in part by the students of Lakehead University, our listeners, and our sponsors. At this time, we would like to thank the following sponsors for their continuous support.
Lakehead Unitarian Fellowship, an inclusive spiritual community promoting a compassionate, just, and sustainable world. Find them online at luf.ca, on Facebook, or at 129 South Algoma, Sundays at 10:30 a.m. The Live from the Rock Folk Festival, bringing the spirit of folk and folk music to Red Rock every August. Keep up to date with upcoming happenings and buy tickets online at livefromtherockfolkfestival.com. The Outpost, Lakehead University's pub, full-service restaurant, and live music venue. Find them on Facebook to stay up to date on all the happenings during the school year, like Tanker Tuesdays and Pub Night Thursdays.
Welcome back. You're listening to CILU 102.7 FM. I'm Josh with It's Pretty Trivial. If you joined us in the first half, welcome back. If you're just joining us now, stay tuned. I left us off on a bit of a cliffhanger in the first half, so I hope not to in the second half. But as we were talking about before, we were talking about Oak Island and kind of the story of it. So without further ado, let's get back into it. A search for an inlet began at Smith's Cove. For its natural advantages for this, 495 feet away from the money pit on the eastern end of the island. Smith's Cove was also suspected as a source of water, as water had been observed as curiously running out of the sand at the center of this cove at times. After shoveling and removing a layer of sand and gravel covering the beach, it was discovered that a bed of brown coconut fiber, 2 to 3 inches in thickness, had been reached, and covering an area 140 feet wide along the shoreline just above the low tide mark and extending to the high tide mark. It was the same kind that had been found in the money pit with the pod auger drilling the year before. Underlying this, and to the same extent, was about 4 to 5 inches of decaying eel grass. Under this was a compact mesh of beach rocks free from sand and gravel. A cofferdam was constructed to hold back the tide and allow for further examination. After this, it was found that the clay had been dug out and removed and replaced by beach rocks. Resting on the bottom of this excavation were 5 well-constructed drains formed by laying parallel lines of rocks about 8 inches apart and covering them with flat stones. These drains, at the starting point, were a considerable distance apart, but converged towards a common center at the back of the excavation. Work went on until half the rocks had been removed, where the clay banks at the extreme sides showed a depth of 5 feet, at which depth a partially burned piece of oak wood was found. About this time, an unusually high tide overflowed the top of the dam, and as it had not been constructed to resist pressure from the inside, while the tide receded, it was carried away. To rebuild the dam, it would have been too costly. It was decided to abandon the work on the shore and to sink a shaft a short distance inland from Smith's Cove and directly over the suspected convergence point, which was suspected to be 25 feet down from the surface of the water. The plan was to drive spiles through and thereby stop further passage of the water. A spot was selected and the shaft was put down, shaft 4, to a depth of 75 feet. Realizing the fact that they must have passed the tunnel, work was stopped on the pit. Another and more careful survey was made, and work was begun on another shaft about 12 feet to the south of the one just abandoned, shaft 5. When a depth of 35 feet had been reached, a large boulder laying in the bottom of the shaft was pried up. A rush of water immediately followed, and in a few minutes, the shaft was full to the tide level. An effort was made to carry out the original program of driving piles, but as the appliances at command were of the most crude description, the effort was a failure. Short time after, shaft 6 was sunk on the south side of the money pit and to a depth of 118 feet. This was the fourth one, including the money pit, that had been put down at this place and in such close proximity to each other that a circle 50 feet in diameter would include the hole. The conditions found in sinking this fourth shaft were precisely the same as the other ones. As already stated, the new shaft was at 150 feet deep, a greater depth by 8 feet than had previously been reached. This is when after the tunnel was driven down, they reached a point directly under a part, or at least of the bottom of the money pit, and it was about time for dinner hour after they had reached kind of the bottom of the money pit. So the workmen had left the tunnel. However, before they finished dinner, a great crash was heard in the direction of the work. Rushing back to the pit, they found that the bottom of the money pit had fallen into the tunnel they had a short time before vacated, and saw that the new shaft was fast filling with water. Subsequently, it was found that 12 feet of mud had been driven by the force of water from the old to the new shaft. The funds of the company were exhausted and it dissolved in 1851. Now, this caused lots of issues, because now they had the money pit that had collapsed, two companies had tried and failed, and things just weren't going very well. Now, one interesting thing about this was when they originally put down their auger, one of the members of the team, Chapel, this was a really interesting time. After everything kind of fell apart, this company was dissolved, Troll Company found, folded, and then the next phase of the island, well, it ended up continuing on. Now, this wasn't the end for Oak Island. Now, the Truro Company, after it had taken over, it had dissolved. Two companies now at this point, well, it failed. However, after about 10 years, the Oak Island Association was eventually formed after the Truro Company. It set about re-cribbing the money pit, which had caved in. The water was bailed out easily and the pit reopened to a depth of 88 feet, where the muddy clay below seemed to be effectively blocking any heavy flooding from Smith's Cove. A new shaft was dug, shaft 7, to a depth of 25 feet east of the money pit, with the intention of intercepting the water tunnel. but was abandoned at 120 feet after it missed the tunnel. Workers began on another shaft, Shaft 8, about 18 feet west of the money pit and 118 feet deep. It is often erroneously credited to the 1850 Truro Company. A tunnel 4 feet high by 3 feet wide was driven from the bottom of the money pit in hopes of striking the treasure vault. It entered the money pit a little below the lower platform. The one bored through at about 105 feet in 1849, where soft clay was found. The tunnel was unwisely driven through the money pit until it nearly reached the east pipe, where the water started coming above on the east side. 3 days of continuous barreling with a horse-operated pumping gin failed to reduce the water in Shaft 8, and water was again seeping up through the money pit. A larger water barreling operation was set up by George Mitchell, and they drove a tunnel from Shaft 7 on the east of the money pit until the shaft also began filling with water. Then with a total of 63 men and 33 horses working in shifts, pumping gins were erected over Shaft 7 and 8 and the money pit. The bailing system in each of the three holes consists of 4 70-gallon casks that were continually lowered, filled, raised, and dumped. They succeeded in almost draining the pits. A tunnel leading from the west of Shaft 8 to the money pit, which was 17 feet long, 4 feet high, and 3 feet wide, was blocked with clay. 2 men were sent in to clear it halfway through the tunnel. When they heard a tremendous crash in the money pit and barely escaped, being caught by a rush of mud, followed them into the west pit and filled up with 7 feet of mud in less than 3 minutes. The resulting crash was the upper platform of the money pit at 98 feet dropping to a lower level, and the bottom platform dropping from 88 to about 102 feet, or a total of 14 feet. And it would suggest that the lower platform on which the chest rested was now down around 119 feet, along with an estimated 10,000 feet of lumber, which also fell, board measure, with some of the cribbing of the money pit. The resulting crash expelled a black old oak timber from considerable girth and three and a half feet in length, which was ejected with the mud and showed evidence of being cut, hewed, chafed, sawn, or bored. And a part of a bottom of a yellow keg was also recovered from the money pit, along with a piece of juniper with bark on and cut at each end, and the spruce slab with mining auger hole in it. The Oak Island Associated raised around additional $2,000 to continue their work. Now, this is starting to go down the rabbit hole and where things really start getting going. Now, one thing I haven't mentioned yet is, I believe it was the one before this, is they had found gold in what was called the Chapel Vault. Now, this is what they called, well, the big box that's mentioned here. Now, again, I'm not going to talk crazy amount on that, but this is the Holy Grail of Oak Island. This elusive pit. After, at least at this point, 8 shafts, not a single one recovering anything of value. Everything seemed to be going bad. And at this point, no one had died, but that would soon change. And there's an interesting thing about Oak Island. Now, I don't believe in curses, really, but it is said that the island is cursed, and 7 people must die for the island to reveal its treasure. And all I will say is, to this day, 6 people have died trying to find this treasure. However, in the fall of 1861, a cast iron pump and steam engine were purchased from Halifax and set up to be driven by steam power at the money pit. The boiler exploded and caused the first death on Oak Island of a man who was scalded to death with other injuries. The name of the man is unknown due to the fact that official government death records started in 1864 and failure of J.B. McCulley to record it in the company records. The boiler explosion was mentioned in author Andrew Learmont Speeden's book, Rambles Among the Blue Noses, about his visit to the island in 1861. The death was not. A note of the death came from an essay by E.H. Owens of Lunenburg and had written about the history of the county in 1868. It happened sometime in the fall after September 30th, 1861, for which the work was stopped for the winter. In the spring of 1862, work resumed. Another shaft was sunk, shaft 9, 107 feet in depth, alongside and connected to the money pit. It was to serve as a pumping shaft for the steam-powered pump. The money pit was then cleared out and recribbed down to 103 feet, at which point the water seeping from below exceeded the capacity of the pump. McNutt said that while the mud was being cleared out of the money pit, the workers came across some of the tools left by the 1849 Truro group at 90 feet, as well as tools belonging to the 1803 Onslow Company at 100 feet. An attempt, again, was used to cut off the water near Smith's Cove by sinking Shaft 10, about 25 feet northeast of Shaft 5, which had been excavated to 35 feet in 1850. And the shaft was dug to 50 feet, and tunnels were driven from various levels until the diggers were eventually flooded out. The Oak Island Association was now broke, but still determined. And after raising a little money, they planned another assault on the drains of Smith's Cove. Because of the limited funds, a proper cofferdam couldn't be built. So work in early spring of 1863 was limited to uncovering a section of the drains near the shore at low tide. On the theory that Shaft 9 pumping shaft wasn't deep enough at 107 feet to efficiently drain the money pit, the workers selected a spot 100 feet southeast of the money pit where they dug Shaft 11, 120 feet deep. The intakes for the pump were placed at the bottom, and the tunnel was driven from a higher level towards Smith's Cove in the hope of intersecting the water network and diverting it to the new shaft. They missed it and gave up, and instead began driving another tunnel towards the money pit itself. But it was soon suspended for about 3 months while the association and devoured to raise more money. And in August 24th, 1863, the Nova Scotian reported that the operation had resumed and that men and machinery are now at work pumping the water from the pits previously sunk. And it is said that they are sanguine that before the lapse of one month, they will strike the treasure. The tunnel from Shaft 11 struck the money pit at a depth of 108 feet. Just above the water level that was being held down by pumps and various other connected shafts. The workers cribbed the area of the money pit between 103 and 108 feet. They then dug a circular tunnel around the outside of the pit at about 95 feet, intersecting a couple of the earlier searcher shafts in the process. It appeared that one or two other lateral tunnels were dug, but the directions and depth were unrecorded. Labor continued sporadically into the following year, but it was gradually found impossible to do any work below 110 feet in the immediate area of the money pit without being flooded out. And the treasure, they believed, was below that. Sometime in 1864, the flood tunnel was struck at about this point where it entered the east side of the money pit. Samuel Fraser, in his letter to A.S. Loudon in 1895, recalled that as we entered he old place of the treasure, we cut off the mouth of the tunnel. As we opened it, the water hurled around the rocks about twice the size of a man's head, with many smaller, and drove the men back for protection. The tunnel was found near the top of our tunnel. They had found the man-made watercourse, but they were powerless to shut it off. The association was even deeper in the red, and the backers thoroughly discouraged. Constant erosion of seawater was undermining the walls of the money pit, and some of the workers were refusing to enter it. The shaft was inspected by mining engineers, who declared it unsafe and advised it to be condemned. That is when the Oak Island Association was finished. Now, again, this would not be the last hurrah for the money pit. Now, I will mention that a lot of this is now starting to unearth a lot more things. After this company, there would be more people. And another company would, well, be made after a while. Now, interestingly enough, one thing about the Money Pit is that the drains, I've always said to have been there, but no one has, it's been one of the elusive things. Recently in the show, as I mentioned in the first half, they actually found what they think is these drains. Now, what's interesting is they have found coconut fiber and things like wood cribbing, which almost looks like a dock, underneath layers and layers of sand and rock and gravel and all, under all of that in Smith's Cove. Now, what's interesting about this is they carbon dated it and it predates the discovery of the Money Pit. Now, this is important as it shows that it is possible. Now, they aren't 100% certain, but it's very likely that Smith's Cove actually has some type of booby-trapped flood system. Now, again, it could be nothing or it could be something, but it's still one of those questions of why is it filling with water? And they know it's seawater because of the way, well, you can test it. Now, this is the point where you start getting into, again, the Oak Island Treasure Company. Now, this is where the Chapel Vault comes from, because this is the one which had William Chapel, and also it had a few other, it had another death and a few other notable things going on. In 1893, Frederick Blair, a 26-year-old insurance salesman living in Boston, developed an obsession with Oak Island that was to last until his death in 1950. He formed the Oak Island Treasure Company and was originally from Amherst, Nova Scotia, and as a boy had heard detailed accounts of Oak Island from his uncle, Isaac Blair, and from Jefferson W. MacDonald, both of whom had taken part in the search in the 1860s. He moved from Brookline, Massachusetts back to Amherst, Nova Scotia in 1895, and in 1893, the first task of this company was to start the search at the Cavan Pit area. Blair suspected that the creator of the Money Pit may have installed a valve or gate somewhere in the flood tunnel to shut off the water. They started to excavate the Cavan Pit. At a depth of 55 feet, seawater began entering it. By the next day, the water was at tide level, about 15 feet from the surface of at the spot. It could not be lowered by bailing, and it was abandoned, but it was still interested in the location and was convinced it's part of the original work. Showed evidence of having been hand dug at an earlier point, and there was no record of previous searchers being in this area or creating a shaft. Years later, other searchers would direct their attention to this pit with the assumption that if it wasn't an air shaft, it would have been an access point for one of the treasure locations. They also assumed the pit wasn't exactly in line with Smith's Cove watercourse, but was set off slightly to the side. And for that reason, the cave-in had not affected the flow of the water. Today, the cave-in pit is a circular crater 100 feet deep and as many feet across. The water in still rises and falls with the tide. In the fall of 1894, another shaft, Shaft 13, was dug 30 feet east of the Money Pit and 8 feet north. Of the suspected line of the water course, water started entering the shaft at 43 feet, probably via an underground connection to the flooded tunnel by previous searchers. It was abandoned. In 1895, Loudon's men began re-excavating the Money Pit, but only got down 55 feet inside the old cribbing when once more water drove them out. It was abandoned until the later part of 1896 when they started again. They were able to drain their new pump with their new pumping equipment and cleared it down to 70 feet before the water became excessive. So old shaft 4 was cleared to 78 feet, at which point water entered it from one side of the tunnel built by the Oak Island, El Dorado, Halifax Company Group in 1860s. But by putting their pumps in the pit, they found they could drain the Money Pit, which they deepened to 97 feet. At about this time, the second death occurred when Maynard Kaiser of nearby Gold River was being hoisted to the top of the pit when the rope slipped off the hoisting pulley and he fell to his death. One of the co-workers, Selvin Refus of Martin's Point, told the story, "We used to hoist the earth up with the horses. Then it was when Kaiser was killed in the pits." Following it, Refus and other workers refused to go down into the pits, forcing operation to be halted for a week. Many of them were convinced that Kaiser's death was a warning and that some ghostly guardian of the buried treasure would kill anyone who tried to retrieve it. The workers were eventually persuaded back, and the deepening of the money pit continued. Blair's notes show that on April 22, 1897, they reached a depth of 110 feet. They came across the old El Dorado Halifax Company tunnels, entering at 108 feet, and noticed all of the water flowing into the pit came through this tunnel. They explored a short distance and came to an intersecting tunnel at the end, which was a large cribbing shaft extending up into the darkness as far as they could see. Blair said, "Water was boiling up through the bottom of this pit, and it proved to be the real money pit. The pit had worked in all winter, proved to be at the old Tupper pit, which was shaft 3, dug in the 1850 to 109 feet and situated 10 feet northwest of the actual money pit. Several months and a lot of money had been wasted in re-excavating the wrong pit. Moving 10 feet to the southeast, they broke through the topsoil and soon confirmed they were now in the original money pit. On June 9th, 1897, digging had progressed to 111 feet in the money pit when the workers came upon an uncribbed tunnel 2.5 feet wide on the east side of the money pit. They dug down quickly, noticing that the opening was filled with smooth beach stones covered with a layer of gravel. And as they dug, water gushed through an ever-increasing rate. They had noticed the flood tunnel from the sea and Smith's Cove, and several accounts state that the tunnel was 2.5 feet wide by 4 feet high. Welling later noted the full height couldn't be seen because of the increasing water volume rushing into the pit. The company directors decided that the best place to stop the flow was at Smith's Cove, and the plan was to set up charges of dynamite underground near the shore, and they hoped that this would demolish the bothersome tunnel for good. Five holes were bored in a line about 50 feet up from the high water mark of the cove, and they were placed 15 feet apart. All but the third hole were bored to about 90 feet without encountering water. They were crammed with dynamite and filled with water, which served as a plug. When dynamite was set off, the water sprayed more than 100 feet in the air, and the third hole apparently bored into a flood tunnel. At 80 feet, the auger struck rocks, and seawater immediately rose to tide level. The hole was filled with a huge 160-pound charge. According to Blair, when it was detonated, the water in both the money pit and the cave-in pit boiled and foamed for a considerable time, and after the disturbance subsided, the oil in the dynamite showed up on the water in both of the pits. Well, it seems the third hole had hit the flood tunnel. The drillers were perplexed by the fact that the seawater this close to the shore wasn't encountered until a depth of 80 feet. They concluded that the tunnel didn't simply run in a direct line from the box drains in Smith's Cove to the money pit, but that they first entered a sump hole that was around 75 feet deep and just inland from the shore, and that the bottom of the hole in the tunnel ran across a very slight gradient to enter the money pit at a depth of approximately 110 feet. However, it ignored two important earlier discoveries. Now, these discoveries had been struck at 35 feet in shaft 5 in 1850 and again in 55 feet down in the cave-in pit in 1894. On the theory that had been suggested to explain the inconsistencies is that there are perhaps two flood tunnels at different levels running between Smith's Cove and the Money Pit. But a more reasonable explanation was offered by W.I. Johnson. His opinion was that the third drill hole didn't exactly penetrate but came very close to it. Then, while the drilling was at 80 feet, the water from the tunnel suddenly burst across in the hole at a higher level, creating the impression that it had been struck at a depth of 80 feet. But the bigger puzzle was to contend with it. The workers assumed the huge charge of dynamite in the third hole had effectively choked off the water supply, yet the pumps were subsequently run in the money pit. They were barely able to keep ahead of the incoming water. The blasting had no effect. Now, this about does it for today's episode. But in subsequent episodes, I'd like to either take a look at it or encourage you to do some research yourself, even watch the show. What's perplexing to me is how, even over 200 years, they still don't know if there's even anything down there. And later on, if I talk about it again, I will talk about how many discoveries and theories have been developed in more recent decades about it. However, it's still perplexing what actually happened in that area. So I hope you enjoyed today's episode, and I hope to hear from you all next week. And I hope you all have a good day. I've been Joshua with It's Pretty Trivial here on CILU 102.7 FM.
As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to spread, it is important to stay safe. Coronavirus is now in Canadian provinces and territories. By law, if you have traveled abroad recently, you must self-isolate. To do your part, stay home as much as possible and practice social distancing. Try to maintain at least 2 meters away from others. Encourage those who are sick or showing symptoms to self-isolate or to seek medical attention. As always, wash your hands frequently, avoid touching your face, and practice good respiratory etiquette by covering your coughs and sneezes. Clean regularly used surfaces. COVID-19 symptoms can mimic colds and flu and include fever, cough, and difficulty breathing. Infected individuals may also have mild symptoms or none at all. For up-to-date information, check reliable sources like your local health authority or the Public Health Agency.